Blog Talk Radio.
Delving past the headlines, sorting through the media bias, exposing the propaganda, and challenging you to use your brain. It's time to tap into the truth.
Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. It is indeed time to tap into the truth. Welcome to today's broadcast. Hope you are having a great day wherever you are and whatever you may be doing. Today, we're going to jump right in with our guest. We are talking to Mr. Joe Kaufman, who happens to be challenging Debbie Wasserman Schultz for the U.S. House seat for the Florida's 23rd Congressional District. And first of all, I would like to thank Mr. Kaufman for his time. Thank you very much for joining us today, sir.
No, thank you for having me. And I'm sorry about my voice. I've been talking a lot lately, and I'm starting to lose it.
Well, I think we can understand that. No apologies needed. You are, after all, in the home stretch in a campaign that, for a lot of conservatives, one of the more important ones, Debbie Wasserman Schultz has for some time been essentially the face of the Democratic Party, serving as chairperson for the National Democratic Committee. She, in my opinion, is not only a Kool-Aid drinker, but she's helping to choose the flavor and helping to stir up fresh batches for the believers.
Not really a face. She's not really a face the Democratic Party can be proud of.
Well, you know, I've kind of wondered, though. I mean, she, to me, I'm not sure how convinced she is. I'm not sure how committed to everything she is, if she's a true believer. I think she is somebody that's dedicated to the cause. I think she tends to be what we kind of coined in the past as useful idiots. I don't think she's an idiot. I just think she wants to do everything she can to push the agenda forward.
Ever since she was named DNC chair, she has been party first, Obama first.
Right.
Everything Obama wants, she pushes for. Everything he doesn't want, she goes against. Before she was named DNC chair, she was a liberal, no doubt, but she had a mind of her own. She was independent on some issues. Now she barely has any independence at all. She goes along with the administration. She goes along with the party line. And that's her existence today, and it's not something to be proud of. She should be ashamed of herself for some of the things that she has said she stands for.
Agreed. All right, before we go too far down into this particular rabbit hole, we'll get back into that. What is it that sets you, for the folks who may not be familiar with you just yet, what sets you apart as far as the better choice, especially for the folks in Florida?
Well, people should understand that I'm for America first, that I'm for bringing back, you know, America from the problems that we have today. We have a never-ending debt, $18 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office says that if Congress continues on its never-ending spending spree, then this is going to be unsustainable for the very near future. But what is Congress doing about it? Nothing, absolutely nothing. People in both parties are ignoring this problem. And I say that the only true way to bring down the debt, the only true way is through what is my passion, bringing up American energy, making America energy independent, doing it in a fast way. Right now we're producing a good amount of energy, but the energy that we're producing today is not going to get us out of the mess that we're in economically. It's not going to stop Russia from going into Ukraine, Crimea. But if we did it in a big way, if we opened up federal lands for energy exploration and production and created a couple new refineries, then we can start speeding up this process where in a good decade or less, we will be energy independent. We won't have to go to places like Venezuela and Saudi Arabia for our fuel needs. They'll have to come to us. We won't have to rely on countries that have horrific human rights records on human rights violations. We won't have to rely on them. We'll have to rely on ourselves, and that's much better than getting our fuel anywhere else. And I do believe it will change our economy. It will bring back hundreds of thousands, millions of new jobs for the United States. It will allow us to bring back that revenue where all those corporations moved their operations overseas. We'll start to bring that revenue back to the United States. I think the key to everything in the United States right now is to bring up energy and bring it up in a big way. And we better do it soon, or else we're going to be facing a problem that's going to be unsustainable.
Well, it's certainly easy enough to agree with that. A lot of folks don't really seem to understand how interconnected that particular issue is with everything else we have going on in the world. Everything from the oil moving through Crimea to the situation in Venezuela, like you pointed out, the economy itself as far as jobs are concerned, and the instability in the Middle East. All these things are interrelated to the world's energy needs. And, yeah, it's very difficult to disagree with you that if we take the steps necessary to become independent, which we can, that it makes it a lot easier to deal on the world stage with these other issues. What, as a newly minted member of the House of Representatives, assuming you win the election, do you do right out the bat to try and make this happen?
Well, I would be certainly a vocal advocate for these things. I would push for bills to open up federal lands for energy exploration and production, as I mentioned. You mentioned the situation with regards to Russia. The reason why it's so important to be energy independent here in the United States is because Europe depends on Russia for all of its fuel needs. Russia supplies all the natural gas to Europe. But if America went after that natural gas, which we're sitting on 150 to 200 plus years of natural gas energy. It's clean, it's abundant, it's cheap energy. It's not like, you know, what the radical environmentalists hate about, you know, fossil fuels. Natural gas is clean energy. If we had a huge supply of it here in the United States and we started going after it, we can offer that energy to Europe so that they won't have to rely on Russia. And if they don't have to rely on Russia for their fuel needs, then Russia wouldn't even think about going into Ukraine, because already Russia's economy is being decimated. But the one thing that Russia has, which Europe needs, is fuel, and we'd be able to stop them there. With regards to Venezuela, you know, I remember during the Bush administration, I think it was the worst thing that the Bush administration did when Chavez left the seat of power, when he left his presidency. He left for 3 days and then he came back. It would have been the greatest thing for the Bush administration to grab him, like the Clinton administration did in Haiti, grab Chavez out of there and put him in a different country, and put in place a government that's more friendly towards the United States. That didn't happen, and because of that, because we allowed Chavez, today we have someone even worse. Nicolas Maduro, who actually orders his National Guard to shoot it at youth peacefully protesting, students protesting in the streets. It's disgraceful. He should be brought up on war crimes for what he's done, shooting at unarmed people. But we didn't do that. But if we were energy independent, then we wouldn't need to rely on Venezuela, and the Venezuelan government would fall. And we would be able to have, in place of the Maduro government, a more friendly government. And certainly with regards to the Middle East, everything in the Middle East is about oil. It's all about oil. And if we were energy independent, didn't have to go to places like Saudi Arabia, certainly if we found a new fuel that would replace oil, which is, you know, maybe somewhere in the near future for us and the rest of the world doing, then our enemies wouldn't have a lot of money to spend on terrorist activity, because a lot of that money comes from oil. Right. So it would have a drastic effect on foreign policy. It's not just bringing up the economy here in the United States, but it would do wonders for the rest of the world and for how we interrelate with the rest of the world, and it would allow us to have more friends around the world. It's something that we need to do, and unfortunately, there are these few small pockets of groups of radical environmentalists who pull the strings of people like Barack Obama and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. There's a guy in California, I think, who's offered the Democratic Party $50 or $100 million just to talk about global warming and climate change, and have policy, American policy, based on this theory, and it's things like that bring down our nation. We need to bring up our nation, and like I said, we need to put America first and stop worrying so much about political correctness. Start going after the energy and bringing up our economy and helping us with our foreign policy.
Right. Well, again, it sounds like you've done the research. You've put some thought into it. Always a plus for a candidate. Delving a little further into it, I've always kind of thought, although it's been kind of an unspoken rule, that the policy long-term towards the Middle East has been we support the oil economy there because it's helpful to the royal families who are more secular and they're a little more friendly to us, a way of helping to keep them in power and in authority. Do you think there'd be any danger to further destabilizing the area if that was to be a sudden shift in our own policy, or do you think it would kind of straighten itself out in short order?
Well, it is a possibility that it would destabilize the area further, such as in a place like Saudi Arabia, where we get a lot of energy from. That's true. However, as I said, the Congressional Budget Office has stated that if we continue on this course of spending, if we continue to build up our nation's debt, then the debt is going to be unsustainable, and we're not going to have a country to worry about in the near future if we continue on this course. So we have to do what's necessary to bring back our country and bring back our economy, even if it means that part of the world is more destabilized. And let's just face it, I mean, we could never think that it would be any more destabilized than it is today. I mean, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Lebanon, it's total chaos. And I do believe, and I'm not going to blame it on the United States, but I do believe that our foreign policy has done some harm and has caused some of this chaos to occur. I'll give you an example. In a place like Libya, you know, who wanted another war, you know, in the Middle East? Why was it necessary for the Obama administration to go in and bomb the military forces of Muammar Gaddafi alongside NATO? And really, the truth is, we run NATO. President Obama said no, NATO would have backed off. But why was this so necessary? When President Bush was in office, one of the best things that happened with regards to the war in Iraq, and war in Iraq I think it was run horribly, the war. But that aside, one of the good things that happened with regards to the war in Iraq very, very early in the war was that Libya had given over its WMD program to the U.S. Libya had renounced terrorism. So there was no threat whatsoever to America, to Israel, or any Western power around the world from Libya, from the regime of Muammar Gaddafi. Now, he may have not been great to his people, but if I were one of the citizens of Libya, I would sure as hell want to live rather live under Muammar Gaddafi than under any Al Qaeda organization. So today you have remnants of Al Qaeda groups in power, and you have other Al Qaeda groups running rampant throughout Libya. It caused us to close shop in Tripoli. Today the largest hub for Al Qaeda is in Libya, and and it's all thanks, and we got four good Americans killed because of this, and it's all thanks to the Obama administration that wanted to have a war and get rid of Muammar Gaddafi. Again, there was no threat there, so there was no point in it. So we created chaos in an area where there was no chaos, and America had an interest in Libya, even though, you know, Muammar Gaddafi was not a friend to the U.S. Certainly had blood on his hands from the past. I hope he's resting in hell today. But we had an interest in Libya, and today there is no interest. Today it's entire chaos, and that was something that U.S. foreign policy caused. And if I were in Congress, I would have been speaking out against that war. Unfortunately, I would have been a lone voice in speaking out against it. But we need some lone voices in Congress today. We need strong voices in Congress today to tell them what they're doing wrong, or to tell them not to ignore these problems, because in the end, things are going to be much worse. There's going to be a lot more harm done if we get involved in an action like that than had we stayed out of it. And that's what I would have said over and over again on the floor of Congress, and I would have explained myself. And if anyone knows my background, I've got somewhat of an expertise in this area. So I have a lot to base my opinions on. And back then I was right when I spoke out against it. And I predicted things like Benghazi that were going to take place, and it all happened. And now it's chaos. And same thing in Iraq and Syria as well. It's total chaos, and our foreign policy in those areas as well has been horrific. We cause more problems than help the situation. Certainly nobody's throwing roses at us over there. They're plotting our destruction over there.
Well, I definitely think that there was there's no mistake. Muammar Gaddafi was no threat to anyone other than the Al-Qaeda and Muslim Brotherhood forces that were looking to try and sweep into the area.
Exactly.
Those who
he was fighting, like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was part of Al-Qaeda, are now in power.
Right.
You know, we empowered the Al-Qaeda groups.
And we keep being told that Obama and his little crew are always the smartest people in the room. So we're led to believe either that's a lie or they knew what they were doing all along. So there's definitely at least a very question. People should be asking the question, why did we do this? I think there was a calculated risk as far as Gaddafi, because Americans remember the name Gaddafi. So they know, hey, this is a guy, he doesn't like us. Go. And they calculated that we would just rubber stamp and say, go ahead, knowing that not a lot of people knew that in recent years he had come along. He was complying. He was giving up the nuclear ambitions. Essentially, he was starting to play nice on the world stage. And I don't know if it was a matter of him losing a taste for that level of defiance and all the negative things that came from it, or if he felt he was going to soon need assistance from governments like ours and other Western governments to help maintain his power base. Because there's no question, the people in that area knew that the Muslim Brotherhood and that Al-Qaeda were on the rise. They may not have seen yet ISIS in its current form, but they knew something was coming. I don't know which it was, but certainly can't help but wonder what our administration was thinking when they felt it necessary to go in, and how hot and focused he wanted to get into Syria initially, too.
Oh, right. And
again,
and of course, this whole thing, as you say, you know, it hinged on the Muslim Brotherhood, or at least the Islamists. When President Obama spoke out for the revolution that was taking place, for the Arab Spring that was taking place in Egypt, the bottom line was that if the revolution against Mubarak was successful, it would have propelled the Muslim Brotherhood into power, and it did. And thankfully today, the military has taken over. Now, who knows in the near future if that's going to be the case. America keeps on trying to put pressure on Egypt to have new elections, which may result in another Islamist getting into power, maybe someone even worse than Mohamed Morsi was, maybe Sharia law even more than Morsi was pushing it. In Libya, same thing. Get rid of Gaddafi and put in place Islamists. So now we have al-Qaeda elements running the show in Libya and chaos all over Libya. And yes, President Obama threatened with that famous or infamous red line with regards to Assad, and no doubt, I mean, Assad is an evil guy. Assad is definitely an enemy of the United States, definitely an enemy of Israel, an ally of Iran. But those that were fighting Assad were led by the Muslim Brotherhood. And when and ISIS has only been a recent creation because of all the chaos that has taken place, we've allowed a group, groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, groups like Hamas and al-Qaeda to metastasize into these new things like ISIS or al-Nusra in Syria, things that, you know, groups that thrive off of total bloodshed, just indiscriminate killings, and really it's come as a result of the chaos in the Middle East. When President Bush went to war in Iraq to get rid of Saddam Hussein, originally the war was targeting Baathists, but because we were in Iraq for so long, where our troops, who were essentially they were all, the only ones that were uniformed, they basically had bullseyes painted on their chests and backs and heads. You know, the idea was to go after the Baathists, but then all of a sudden, when you're there for so long, all of a sudden, al-Qaeda starts coming into play because the Iraqis are starting to get frustrated over the American presence. And so al-Qaeda starts to build al-Qaeda of Iraq, which was the precursor of ISIS today. Unfortunately, our involvement in these places is doing a lot more harm than good. And we have to take a step back and with our foreign policy and start wondering where to get involved, who to get involved, you know, with, and what's the end game in this? What's the end game? And if we want to attack one group or another, hey, I'm with Americans. I'm just as angry as any American at this group, ISIS, for killing two innocent journalists, Americans. And I want to see that group decimated and destroyed, just like a lot of Americans. But I'm also concerned about who we're going to be partying with over in Syria and Iraq to do so, who's going to benefit from it. Are we going to side with another terrorist group to get rid of one terrorist group? And how long is it going to take? How many boots on the ground are going to have to be used? How many American troops are going to die as a result of it? And how long are we going to be there for? These are all serious questions. And as congressman, I wouldn't just push for wars to take place. I would ask all the tough questions and make sure that all these questions are answered before we ever think about going into another war again. We certainly don't want to see another, you know, Iraq happen. We just got out of that, and we don't want to see a repeat of it.
Right. All right, sir. Let's go ahead and change gears a little bit. I mean, realistically, we could probably sit here and talk about this for a full hour if time allowed. But in fairness to the folks that are listening in, maybe some folks that are still on the fence trying to decide if they want to support you, let's try and get some more issues out here so you can have your say on them. Let's take up Obamacare, for example.
Well, it's very simple, and I'll tell you. Earlier in the day, we had a tailgate party at the Dolphins games, first game of the season. They're playing the New England Patriots. And anyway, a lot of people brought up Obamacare, and they said, how do you feel about Obamacare? Because the truth is that even though it's an issue that's lessened over time, because things like ISIS and other issues have come to the forefront in recent months, but it's still a huge issue. I mean, it is true that Debbie Wasserman Schultz and others voted to remove $700 billion from Medicare to pay for Obamacare. It's going to hurt seniors tremendously. And maybe these seniors don't see it today, but after the election, they may get a surprise. And I have a feeling that that information is going to be coming out, you know, before election time. Obamacare, at the Dolphins game, all these doctors approached me, a group of doctors approached me and told me about all the horrors that they have to deal with now because of Obamacare. It's hurt so many people in so many different ways. And yes, it's true that this issue of pre-existing conditions, which was a great issue to bring up, with Obamacare or without Obamacare, it was a great issue to bring up. It needed to be addressed. And yes, maybe some people are able to get health care that couldn't before, but there's no reason why that couldn't have happened with regards to the free enterprise system. You know, in a place like Florida, before Obamacare, you had a half a dozen companies creating the price for all Floridians. So they were able to set price, called an oligopoly, just like a monopoly, where you had a small group of corporations, of insurance companies, creating price for everybody. But how about instead of a half a dozen companies in the state of Florida, which is very similar to most, if not all, of the other states, how about having all of the states compete across state lines so that you have 300-plus companies, small and large, competing against each other? And through that competition, you'll be able to find out which ones are the good companies, which ones are the bad companies, and the bad ones will surely go out of business because they won't be providing as good a care as others. You'll be able to drop price because this competition will bring maybe not free health care, but it will bring the lowest price possible. And you can address pre-existing conditions at the same time with the use of risk pools, just like they do in the auto insurance companies. And there's other things we can do as well to bring down the cost. I mentioned the main one, to have competition across state lines, but you can have things like tort reform, where you stop unnecessary testing for doctors, which costs so much money and wastes so much time. You could stop these malicious lawsuits from taking place. Also, costs so much money and takes up so much time for doctors and everyone. You can have menu pricing for hospitals and medical facilities, and so that you know generally the cost of your bill before you wind up with that bill. All of these things will help with competition and will bring down the price. And that's really what we're looking for in America. We're looking for affordable health care that's good health care, and that's what competition does. It brings down the price, and it brings up the quality, and that's not what government-run health care does. That's not what anything that's run by the government does. You know, the government does some great things, but you know what? They never do it well. They always wind up costing so much more money than it should. And healthcare is one of those areas. And not to mention, it's unconstitutional. It doesn't say anything in the Constitution about providing healthcare for the citizens of the United States. It says limited government in our economic policy at home, in our domestic policy, and also limited government with regards to our foreign policy, maybe not getting involved in all of these unnecessary wars like we mentioned in Libya, things like that. Limited government is the way to go. Our forefathers are rolling in their graves today with how we treat the United States Constitution. Really, the Constitution of the United States barely exists today. It's basically a prop for politicians to hold up when they're giving a speech. And to be honest, I've done it myself. But it's something that we need to embrace. Constitutions is one of the greatest works ever created, and we need to listen to it, because the guys that created it, they were geniuses. They created this small document that was a genius document, and our country has been around for over 200 years because of it. And in order to stick around for another 200 plus years, we need to adhere to the Constitution.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. Is there anything in your particular race that has transpired so far that you didn't expect to happen, just specific to you going head-to-head against Debbie Wasserman Schultz?
No, I mean, her rhetoric is off the charts today just as much as it was a couple of years ago. I mean, if you look at the statements that she makes, you know, the radical statements against Governor Scott Walker, or talking about how Americans, you know, justifying all of the coal mining jobs that have been lost in West Virginia and elsewhere by saying that Americans use too much energy and it's causing part of South Florida to sink into the ocean. I think she believes that's going to happen, or at least she's saying these things with a straight face. But really, I mean, well, there's also, listen, let's talk about the election itself, election time. I just got through a primary, which I won, of course, and the voters, the amount of voters was very small. In fact, it was a record. I shouldn't say record low turnout, but it was the lowest turnout in 16 years. So there's a lot fewer voters coming out to the polls, but that's not necessarily bad for me personally in my campaign, because we believe that there's going to be a lot of Democrats staying home. If you look at the ballot that's going to come up in early voting, and of course on November 4th for Election Day, which is just 2 months, you know, from now essentially, the Democrat voters are going to have really terrible choices. I mean, they've got Debbie Wasserman Schultz for one major race, and then you've got Charlie Crist for another. And I'll tell you, I can't stop hearing Democrats speak out against Charlie Crist. I mean, they really don't like the guy. I think they're willing to stomach it because they think he may actually win. But the truth is that that nobody likes the guy. He's flip-flopped on every single issue. I don't think Democrats have many choices. I don't think they like Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I hear from Democrats all the time how much they dislike her, either her policies or her personally. And I hear from Democrats all the time how they're going to vote for me in November. And many Democrats came to the polls saying that they wish they could vote for me in the primary, but they weren't registered Republican. Have I seen anything strange? No, I haven't. But the Democrat voters, as well as all the voters, are upset regarding Obamacare. It's hit them personally. I'm sure that Democrats, I know Republicans and Independents don't like what Debbie Wasserman Schultz says when she gets interviewed. All the radical rhetoric that she spews out of her mouth. But they, you know, I think a lot of Democrats, I know a lot of Democrats don't appreciate it as well. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the head of the DNC. She's trying to play to the far left. And fortunately, that's not this district. That's not District 23. District 23 has some individuals that are firm Democrats that will always vote Democrat no matter what. But I think there's a lot more Democrats out there that are moderates that don't appreciate the terrible rhetoric that comes from people like Wasserman Schultz, and they'll vote against her. And they'll vote for a Republican that they that they believe they can trust that they believe is honest, and I am. I'm an honest guy. I'm no saint. I don't know who is, but I'm an honest guy, and I think that a lot of voters sense that. I know a lot of Democrats sense that, and because of all these things and so many other factors, I truly believe I'm going to be sitting in the United States House of Representatives come this January.
All right. Is there any other issue, topic that you'd like to discuss real quick?
I mean, there's so many different issues. I mean, you know, of course, there's Hobby Lobby, which affects Catholics first and foremost, which Debbie, I believe, you know, her attacking Hobby Lobby is really an attack on Catholics, bigger than that, attack on Christians. I think maybe even attack on all religious individuals. I know as a Jew myself, you know, I'd be heavily offended if the federal government forced Orthodox Jews to do something against their religion, like sell pork products. That's essentially what the federal government was doing to Hobby Lobby, and unfortunately, you know, once again, the rhetoric was off the charts with Wasserman Schultz, and it's not her rhetoric is against common sense, and it's way over the top. And once again, I'll say that the district is not that far left. It's not a representation of Debbie Wasserman Schultz right now is the representative of the district, but she doesn't represent the mindset of the people of the district, and she also doesn't represent the district. She's as DNC chair, she's all over the country. You know, I want to know the last time that people actually considered her as really their representative, somebody representing their needs, their wants. It's, you know, ever since she's been DNC chair, it's just non-existent. As congressman in the United States, as a member of the House of Representatives, I will take calls from everyone in the district. I won't care if they're Democrats or independents or Republicans. I won't care if they're the far left and they just want to, you know, they just want to talk to me, maybe even criticize me for a stance that I take. I'm willing to speak to them and meet with them. I won't have to take a donation from them in order to have a meeting with them, as I've heard Wasserman Schultz being accused of time and time again. I'll be someone that represents the people of the district, and it's something that Wasserman Schultz doesn't do. As DNC chair, she's all over the country. But the truth is that she has a responsibility as a member of the United States House of Representatives to represent the people, the constituents of her district, and she doesn't do it. And when she does it poorly, but she doesn't do it. And that's got to stick in the minds of the voters of District 23. Do they want to vote for someone who puts their party first, who puts President Obama first, or do they want to vote for someone who puts America first and who puts the constituents first? And that someone is me. And that's the case that I bring to the voters of District 23, and I only hope that they make the right choice.
All right. If anybody wants to do any more research, check out your website, maybe make a contribution. I trust they can probably do that from your website. What is your website? What's your social media contacts? Let you go ahead and throw that out.
It's www.kaufmanforcongress.com. That's K-A-U-F as in Frank, M as in Mary, A-N as in Nancy, just one F, one M, one N. So Kaufman4Congress.com, www.kaufmanforcongress.com. Our Twitter handle is Joe Kaufman, at Joe Kaufman USA, at Joe Kaufman USA. And our Facebook page is Elect Joe Kaufman. And I also have a personal Facebook page as well. But if anybody wants to get in touch with me, I'll be glad to answer any question or concern that they have. And certainly if anybody wants to donate to the campaign, our campaign would appreciate it and certainly needs it. We're going to be doing advertising and mailers and things like that and a lot more, God willing. And it's very important for the campaign, as everyone knows. So please go to our donate page at KaufmanForCongress.com. I thank you so much for having me on your show. It's been a pleasure.
Actually, you are more than welcome, and you're more than welcome to come back, too. Hopefully, here in a few months, you'll be on your way to the Congress, and hopefully you'll come back on the show and tell us about how things are going after you've had a chance to settle in.
I would love to. And I will be doing so soon.
Okay. Well, again, best of luck to you. You have my support. Unfortunately, I'm outside of your voting district, so I don't know how much it actually helps. But I love any candidate that talks common sense and has the sincerity when they're saying it. And I definitely get that from you. What you were saying earlier about people picking up that they can trust you, that you're honest, I definitely get that from your speech. I get that from how you talk and from some of the other interviews I've heard you give. Definitely wish you the best of luck, sir.
Thank you. Take care. Be well. Bye.
All right. Bye. Thank you. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Joe Kaufman. He is challenging Debbie Wasserman Schultz in the House of Representatives, the Florida's 23rd Congressional District. Those of you who may not be that familiar with the area, that's the district that covers parts of Broward and Miami-Dade counties. Like Mr. Kaufman said, there are some districts down there that vote Democratic out of habit as much as anything else. But he seems to be making some inroads there. And it's good to imagine. I mean, I think that's probably the case that a lot of actual honest-to-goodness conservatives are seeing when they're running for these offices now. I talked about it before on the show about how I'm seeing signs of hope, how I'm seeing some of the folks who had been just diehard, well, I hate to use the term in this case because they're coming around, but they have been Kool-Aid drinkers in the past, had refused to even listen to what other people were saying in regards to, well, what about this policy? What about this problem here? The problem we keep running into has always been those people that put party first and facts second. Party first and what's best for America as a whole second. That's been part of the problem. It's people are starting to wake up. I think Obamacare has done more to help awaken a lot of Democratic sleepers, Kool-Aid drinkers, than anything else, because as more and more people are feeling the effects, more and more people are starting to realize, you know what, these people have been lying to us to our faces, and they knew they were lying. Now, some folks still aren't there yet, but I see it around here in Tennessee, and I hear candidates like Mr. Kaufman talk about how people who have traditionally been in the other side in the voting booth seem to be more receptive to the message now. So, again, I see signs of hope. And, again, one of the other things that I wish I had mentioned, but I wanted to give Mr. Kaufman a full opportunity to get what he was saying, and I feel like I owe that to the listeners, that you get to hear them as much as possible rather than me interject my own things here and there, although I do it to kind of segue. We have these issues going on, and we have people that are looking directly at these issues, and people feel helpless, so they just keep voting the way they've always voted. And we've got to move past that. We're hearing more and more candidates talk about how they're not just going to follow party lines. And as long as that's the case, then these are the exact kinds of people that we need to be electing and sending forward. That's what our government was initially supposed to be made of. Mr. Kaufman himself said that the people who put together our Constitution were geniuses. And a lot of them were, because they spent time looking at every aspect. They did not want a single unintended consequence to pop up. They wanted to make sure that as they put together a framework for a government, that it would provide liberty to the individual person, and then to protect that liberty for as long as possible. The Constitution is not just a prop. The Constitution is not just an old document that's no longer relevant in the modern world, the way I've heard some people describe it. The Constitution is the framework for the greatest government that had ever existed on the planet at that time. And that's complete with the Electoral College. That's complete with the state legislatures electing the Senate, and with the people electing the U.S. House of Representatives members. The House was meant to be the voice of the people. The Senate was meant to be the voice of the states, thereby protecting states' rights. And the other branches were designed to put a check in place. The legislature can pass any law they want, but the president has to sign off on it, or the president can veto it. But then the legislature can override that veto if there's enough support. But then, once that law goes into effect and someone has standings, they can begin the process of eventually getting it into the federal court system, and maybe even eventually to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court then will decide whether the legislature should have ever passed this law in the first place. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is an embarrassment to the Democratic Party. But there's a lot of people at the national level that don't see it that way. Why? Because she's carrying water for them. She's going out there. She's being a public face. She's hoping to be rewarded by the national party for doing so. She's willing to take whatever shots that she gets taken. But what everyone needs to realize is that people are awakening. And it seems like more often than not, or at least in the past, the midterm elections normally have more voter turnout among people who actually know what's going on, people who are at the very least paying a little more attention. You know, I've actually mentioned in the past, I would support people having to take a cursory test before being allowed to vote in an election. Here, let's take just a general test that says Joe Biden is, and we can even make it multiple choice. Joe Biden is TV game show host, radio talk show host, Vice President of the United States, U.S. District Court judge. Questions like that. Questions in regards to specific issues that might be coming up. Which do you prefer, the Affordable Health Care Act or Obamacare? And then in this test, I might even be talked into, if you make it a 20-question test with questions along those lines, I might even be convinced that you can let somebody miss one of those and still let them vote. But if you can't answer these basic questions, then you probably have no business voting. Everybody, you always hear, come out and vote, turn out and vote, turn out and vote. Let's go, let's get out, let's get out, let's go vote. I used to be one of those people too, but I have actually gotten to the point now where I much prefer, if you don't know the issues, if you don't know what's going on, if you're just going out to vote for a single issue mentality, or if you're just going out there to support a political party, then stay home. Don't go vote. Don't go vote. You don't deserve to get to go vote if that's the only reason you want to vote. You need to know what all the possible ramifications are. Mr. Joe Coughlin comes out, and he starts out the bat talking about U.S. energy policy. And like we discussed, the reason he starts there is because so many of the other major issues, even the ones that we're not focusing on very much right now, you know, the economy, jobs, things like that, even Obamacare to an extent, they all get intertwined and intertangled with U.S. energy policy. If we become energy independent, if we put people back to work in the coal mines, utilizing the new techniques and the clean coal burning, which, you know, I've heard the critics say, and I can't help but wonder myself, how clean can coal burning be? But if you've made improvements and it's better now than it was before, call it what you want. Why not control the optics? That is, after all, how the other side controls the argument, isn't it? We get into the natural gas. We've been having this conversation for better part of a decade now. It's got to be coming up on 8 years, close to it, about how we are the Saudi Arabia of the world in natural gas. We have it. So why aren't we using it? Why aren't we taking more steps? Well, I think for the longest time, like I mentioned earlier, that we have used our petrodollars to help support royal families, the more secular groups that managed to gain control over Arab countries. And the reason and rationale for that is that these people are more interested in maintaining control than they are in instituting Sharia, because they know quickly if they institute Sharia in a real way and they're seen to be supporting it, then they can't side with the great Satan anymore. They can't do business with the great Satan anymore. I mean, they can try to make their arguments that, hey, blah, 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 we're just taking their money and then we'll use it against them later. All that being said, though, we have supported our, quote, allies in the region. That way, we've propped up governments to slow down the spread of fanatical Islamo-fascist ideology. We've done that in areas that are still predominantly, by their population, people that embrace that ideology. We do need to do more to support our ally, Israel, in the area. We do need to do more to cripple Hamas's capability to act as a terrorist organization. If they want to create some offshoot to actually govern the people of Gaza and renounce their terroristic ties and their terroristic ways, then fine. The people who are suffering most are the people of Gaza itself. Next up behind that are the people of Israel. Why does that concern us here? Well, other than the fact that Israel is an ally, aren't we supposed to care when innocent people are being attacked for no real reason other than prejudice and hatred? Aren't we supposed to be addressing that type of activity? Isn't that supposed to be the conscience of America? Us, moving toward a world where we no longer permit or allow racial action or prejudicial action against groups of people who've done no real wrong to the people attacking. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? I think I've heard something similar to those words coming out of speeches from people like the Reverend Al Sharpton and the Reverend Jesse Jackson. I'm pretty sure I've heard these kind of things from these folks. So is that the case or not? So we need to do more. What can we do? A couple of weeks back, had Danny Page back on the show. And he said that, constitutionally speaking, there's not much we can do. And in strict interpretation, you could make that argument, because nowhere in the Constitution does it say that we have a direct responsibility to intervene
on behalf of our allies, period. But it does say that we can create treaties, and those treaties, as long as they don't violate U.S. sovereignty, like some of the U.N. treaties that Obama and his administration have been trying to push lately, as long as these treaties do not violate U.S. sovereignty or try to institute U.N. rule, that would be a violation of U.S. sovereignty, for those of you that don't get it. And for regular listeners, I'm not talking to you, anybody from the left that might have accidentally found the show, if you need some step-by-steps, that was for you. So there's actually nothing constitutional preventing us from getting involved either. Do we want another war? No. And I'm not calling for a war. I'm not. But instead of showing signs of weakness and not being supportive, we need an administration that actually is willing to stand up and be strong on the American stage and on the world stage. Not somebody that's going to waffle and then say, we don't have a strategy for dealing with ISIS, and now, after a few days, they have a strategy. The holdup. Both working on your short game, that much more important. American citizens are getting killed. Innocent Christians and other minorities have been getting slaughtered. Or worse, and yes, there are things worse than just being killed. Being savagely gang raped and then sold into slavery, that might be worse. I tend to think that it would be. Maybe it's just me. I suppose it's all a matter of where you're sitting. And of course, when you're sitting here in the United States, you feel safe. You feel like it's their problem, and maybe you feel bad for what's happening to them, but you still don't feel like it's really your problem. I pray that it stays that way. Going to go ahead and take a break, and then when we get back, we're going to shift. We're going to talk a little bit more about the new plan to deal with ISIS. We'll hit a few other news topics. I will be opening up the phone line, so anybody who wants to call in, feel free. We will have those topics. If you want to get ready now, you may do so by calling 347-426-3550, and we'll take your calls as you come in. I will not be screening calls. However, all I do ask is that you keep it clean. I will cut you off quickly if you do not. In the meanwhile, stay with us. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back. Thanks for staying with me. I appreciate everybody listening in. Not a lot of activity going on in the chat room today. I kind of got the chat room started late, so hopefully folks who started listening in early will still have an opportunity to refresh their page and get along with us. Quick reminder, the music that I play during the breaks, when I do take the breaks, is from a service called Magnitude, so it's all podcast safe and all that wonderful jazz, completely legal. But the one thing that I like about Magnitude is the fact that they deal with independent artists. These are people that are making music for the joy of music, trying to make a living out of it, perhaps,
still doing the step-by-step rolling to that next level as best they can. I really, really like the idea of helping people that are trying to do something on their own. Taking the chance, stepping out there, doing what they've got to do of their own accord. So that's why I like Magnitude, and that's why I use it. So something else, if you guys are doing your own show or thinking about doing your own show, which if you're listening here at Blog Talk or if you're catching the show in podcast form later, whether it's right here or at iTunes, where you can find the show, or at Stitcher.com or at TuneIn.com, any one of those places, you can find the podcast. It is available. If you're listening, one of those places, take a look at Magnitude and take a look at doing your own show. That's the great thing about the modern internet, the great thing about the modern technology we have available. You can do more than just sit back and listen. You can do more than just call in. You can make your own show. You can step up to the mic and be prepared to have your voice, your opinion, your concerns addressed. And speaking of concerns, and speaking of having Danny Page on the show recently again, I wanted to make a quick little statement. See, Washington, D.C. was once a place where men of honor went to debate the issues and to govern the land with the best interest of America in mind. Unfortunately, it has since become a swamp, a literal cesspool filled with quicksand and vipers and other predators with no goal other than to acquire wealth and power at the expense of the American people. Now, there is only one way to fix that, and that is we, the people, must elect men and women of great character and high moral standards, people who will hold themselves and their colleagues accountable to those standards, people who will listen to their constituents, who will stand up and honestly debate the issues instead of playing partisan politics or trying to spin, but to honestly debate the issues, the pros and cons, and to go on the record. Men and women who will once again put America first. So with that in mind, I'm doing something that I have never done on this show before. In fact, I have never publicly done. Although I have actually already made this announcement, I have officially endorsed a candidate, and I'm doing that right now. With this in mind, I do, in fact, wholeheartedly and without reservation, endorse Danny Page for U.S. Senate. Tennessee needs a conservative voice in D.C., and America deserves better, Lyndon Lamar Alexander. So if you are in Tennessee, I hope you will take the time to take a look at Danny Page. Consider voting for him. That's all I'm asking. Also, if you're in Florida and you're in the 23rd District, I hope you will take the time, if you're not already familiar with Mr. Kaufman, that you will take the time to look up his website, that you will take the time to check out what his platform is, what his concerns are, what his background is, and then decide for yourself who's a better voice for your district. Mr. Joe Kaufman, who talks common sense, or Ms. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who, well, talks a lot of nonsense. And that's being about as polite and diplomatic about it as I can be. I mean, let's face facts. If you're familiar with Ms. Wasserman Schultz, then I don't have to tell you about her. And if you're not familiar with her, then you probably either don't pay attention to the Democrats at the national level, or you're not from Florida, in which case that election doesn't really affect you very much. But it kind of does, doesn't it? Whenever we're voting for somebody for Senate, or whenever we're voting for somebody for the House of Representatives, if we know this is somebody that's just going to vote party lines, then we are, in fact, requiring the rest of the country to live with that vote as well as ourselves. We want somebody to be our voice. And there is no way that we can send people to the House of Representatives and they be a representative of their district, their constituents, and they just fall in line with the party. It's not possible because the needs of District 23 in Florida are different than the districts of 17 in Tennessee. Can we trust these people to be our voice and then still have them vote in a fashion that makes sense for America as a whole? Yeah, that should be the expectation. And I am perfectly okay with my elected official going to D.C. and then voting a certain way that I don't necessarily agree with personally, as long as he is willing to, he or she, I just know somebody's waiting to pounce on that, as long as he or she is willing to come back here to the district and explain to me why and hear my concerns, again, if I've already expressed them, because that's part of the job. A lot of these folks, they don't think that's part of the job anymore. They think they can hide behind phone banks and their office people, and they don't actually have to accept phone calls, and they don't have to do the actual work part of being a representative. There is a reason, boys and girls, why you get a full-time salary as a member of the U.S. House, as a member of the Senate. The work itself is more than just showing up roughly a third of the time and casting a vote. There are some elected officials that seem to think that that is the job. They don't have to do anything else. That, and of course, go and fundraise. So they're not raising funds for themselves, they're raising funds for the party. If they're not raising funds for the party, they're raising funds for some charity, which in turn will then make a contribution to the party. So around and around it goes. These people literally beg you for their vote. They literally beg you for your money to help them spend more money so they can beg other people for their vote. The least we should expect from them is for them to do the job they're begging to have. I got the impression from Mr. Kaufman a little while ago, he is a man who would do the job. I trust that he is far more likely to do it than Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is, of course, way too busy traveling all around the country as the DNC chairperson. I would say, in Debbie's defense, it's a big responsibility, and the biggest of which is fundraising, and she has to put the party in line when she does that job. That's as far as I'm willing to go in her defense. To her detriment, is she doing the job she's been elected to do? Is she representing the people of the 23rd District of Florida? Joe Kaufman didn't think so. And he lives there, so I'm going to take his word for it. Anyway, let's go ahead and do that promised change of gears. Wanted to talk about the supposed big move here. We've got Obama finally coming out and saying that we're going to have a strategy. You know, he messed up not too long ago and said that he did not have a strategy for dealing with ISIS. Well, now he says that he has the authority and the U.S. will go on the offensive against ISIS. Oh, well, of course, he calls it ISIL. And that is a major point of contention, by the way, amongst a lot of conservative folks. Because I've heard a lot of people make the accusation that if you're referring to ISIS as ISIL, that you're ignoring Israel's right to exist. And I don't think that that's really the case. Now, I don't question whether or not Barack Obama might think Israel doesn't have the right to exist. I do question, however, if somebody else uses the term, if they're doing the same, because it seems to be the standard reference point, or a standard reference point. And if you hear somebody like, I don't know, the press secretary of the United States constantly say it, or the person who's currently occupying the White House saying it, you might tend to pick it up just out of habit. I myself am going to continue to call it ISIS because that's what it was initially. But it's really about the region. I do think, and I don't know why I've got off on this tangent, but I'll finish this tangent before getting back into it. I do think that ISIL might actually be more geographically correct now than it would have been at its inception. ISIS probably was about as correct as it could be. But I do firmly believe that Israel has a right to exist. If you've listened to the show more than once, I think you've already gotten that. But at any rate, the occupier, a.k.a. Barack Hussein Obama, said today that the United States will go on, quote, the offensive against the Islamic State militants in the Middle East. You know, she said, in the Middle East. He didn't specify where. So he's not leaving one area either specifically in or specifically out. So maybe he's only going into Iraq. Maybe he's hitting Iraq and Syria. Maybe he's going into Jordan. Don't know yet. Guess we'll see. But at any rate, he said that we're going on the offensive against ISIS members in the Middle East, and that he will, quote, further outline his plans in a speech on Wednesday. Now, I'm not really sure if he really needs to outline his plans, because to me, that's kind of like saying, you got 48 hours to get out of town, or we're going to blow you up. 48 hours comes along, and all you've done is you've moved all the stuff that you're afraid of losing out of harm's way. I think we kind of saw that in our second incursion into Iraq, actually. But at any rate, quote, the next phase is us going on the offensive. Now, Obama said this in an interview that aired today on Meet the Press. The occupier, a.k.a. Barack Hussein Obama, also said that on Wednesday he will not announce the use of U.S. ground troops or a campaign equal to the war in Iraq, and that the goal is to make clear the mission is to deal with terror threats like those over the past several years. Which, okay, it's been going on for the last several years. Why are we just now getting a strategy? Just a question. Just like to throw them out there sometimes. Now, he did acknowledge that the ISIS, again, he called it ISIL, is unique because of its territorial ambitions in the Middle East. You see, and again, he's got it wrong. And I don't know if it's intentionally wrong because he wants to keep Americans calm, especially going up so close to the anniversary of a specific event that took place on September 11th, you know, today, the airing of this show, this is Sunday, September the 7th, 4 days away from the anniversary, and we know how they love anniversaries and the symbolism. So maybe he's just trying to keep people calm, or maybe he's still trying to downplay because he doesn't want to admit what the true agenda is, because this is a global agenda. This is not about a territorial ambition in just the Middle East. It's about a territorial ambition of the entire world as a whole. This is not just some caliphate, little c. This is the caliphate, capital C, that they're trying to establish, the one promised to them. The one that they expect, that means that they're going to be ruling the world. So make no mistake, this particular Islamo-fascist threat wants to rule the world. Sounds megamaniacal, right? It is, but that's part of the problem. Now, Barack also said, quote, over the course of months, or maybe I should do my voice, over the course of months, we are going to be able to not just blunt the momentum of ISIL. I hate calling it that, but I'm doing the voice, so I've got to. He said, using an alternate name for the group, ISIL, quote, we are going to systematically degrade their capabilities. We are going to shrink the territory that they control. And ultimately, we're going to defeat them. Has anyone seen my 9-iron? No, wait, he didn't say that. Sorry. Now, the occupier also said that he has, quote, the authority he needs to increase attacks on the Islamic State targets without congressional approval. Now, 9 times out of 10, when Barack is using the language of, I have the authority I need, that usually means he knows he doesn't, but he's trying to bluff his way through. This particular case, War Powers Act gets a little iffy, so it's hard to really say. I don't see anyone in Congress standing up and stopping him from increasing his military activities against ISIS, ISIL, or whatever else you want to call these terrorist thugs. What I do see is the real threat that we might end up finding ourselves creating a bigger mess, like we discussed earlier in our interview with Mr. Joe Kaufman, and that is what happens when you break Libya. So we used to live by an old adage, if you break it, you bought it. We broke Iraq. What did we do to fix it? Well, we hung around a while, and then Barack, even though he claimed it was still Bush's fault, and I don't know how this far into your presidency, if you can call it that, that you can still blame your predecessor when you ran on it, and you even, during your campaign for reelection, was making the promises and making the statements, I said we'd get out of Iraq, and we did it. I said we'd end the war, and we did. You did, but it's still Bush's fault. So which is it? How does it work both ways? But I'll digress from that, and let's get back to this story. They're going to shrink the territory that they control. How are you going to do that without boots on the ground? I don't understand how you accomplish that goal. I mean, you're not going to do that just by bombing. And how are you going to defeat them when every step you've taken over the course of your entire time in office when it comes to foreign policy in the Middle East is what's helped to create them and to make them what they are today? Now, Barack did not answer questions that were asked repetitively about whether he will order airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Syria. He refused to say so. Now, you know, based on the fact that he wanted to go into Syria, and these are the people he was supporting in Syria, he probably wants to be bombing Syria like crazy, but he also probably wants to be bombing someone other than the ISIS targets. When Congress was back on summer break, Barack ordered strikes on the group's military targets in Iraq, saying that they were to protect U.S. personnel and requested by the Iraqi government as part of a humanitarian effort to preserve infrastructure and to save Iraqi minorities. And I think a lot of Americans were probably happy to see him make this move. Maybe it was just me, but I think they were. Because, you know, I, like a lot of people, I've changed my little icon on Facebook to the Arabic letter N to show solidarity and thoughtfulness towards the Christians that were being slaughtered. Felt like we have a moral imperative to help those people. So when we saw this humanitarian effort, it wasn't enough. But I think we supported it for two reasons in my case. I supported it because, yes, I firmly believe in the if you break it, you bought it. We have a moral responsibility to the free peoples of Iraq to try and help maintain a semblance of a reasonable government. Now, that's not an open-ended thing, but it's obviously not a case where we pull out before it's finished. And we knew when it was finished. Now, Barack has often made his decisions based on political parlor games rather than by the facts that are in front of him or by what his people are telling him. And in fact, he's been quicker to fire generals who didn't agree with his foreign policy than he was to listen to what their experience told them he needed to be paying attention to. At any rate, Obama said in this interview that upcoming effort is a part of a three-step plan. It started with intelligence gathering and will include helping install a new Iraqi government. Once again, going back to the Barack voice, and I'm confident we can get this done. Of course he's confident. The man believes that he can lower the rising seas and raise mountains just by the sound of his voice. He's made it quite clear. That's what he thinks. He believes. At any rate, Representative Peter King, a Democrat from New York, and Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington, both were on ABC's This Week. And they said that the president should take swift action instead of trying to get congressional approval and getting bogged down in a prolonged debate. Now, see, once again, this is the Democratic Party saying, hey, Mr. President, just go act unilaterally. The Constitution doesn't matter. And look, here's where it gets to. Again, the War Power Act makes this a tricky kind of situation. First of all, you need to question whether the War Power Act was constitutional in the first place. I've heard a lot of people make the assessment, although a lot of these people are not actually constitutional scholars or lawyers, so take that assessment for what you will, but they made the assessment that the War Powers Act is unconstitutional in and of itself. But here's what I think. I think when you have someone who is the commander-in-chief, they are obligated to act quickly when quick actions are necessary. But they do still have an obligation to go in front of Congress because only Congress can declare war. I don't think you have a hard argument to make that we're already at war with these people because they have declared war on us. And yes, I know. You've heard that a million times by now. It's almost become cliche. We're not at war with Islam. Islam's at war with us. Yes, yes, it is. Islam is literally at war with everyone who is not Muslim. If you're not a Muslim, they're at war with you, whether it's the slow creeping war or the 80-year-old woman getting beheaded in the streets in England. It's a little faster than the slow creeping war, and it is not nice. You want to talk about moderate Muslims? Prime Minister of Turkey came out this past week, and he made the statement that the term moderate Muslim is ugly and racist. Said that Islam is Islam. And, you know, take it from me. This is a guy who would know what he's talking about. The Turkish, one of the Islamic Turkish politicians came out and said this past week that Christianity is no longer a religion. This is the point I've been making about Islam for a long time, and I'm not the only one. I know I'm not the only, I'm not a lone voice on this. I have said that Islam is not a religion. It's more like a murder-loving cult. But now you have politicians in Turkey saying that Christianity is no longer a religion. In fact, quote, Christianity is no longer a religion. Assessment offered by the former environmental and urban planning minister in Turkey, speaking to a gathering sponsored by the Islamic Justice and Development Party. You probably heard them referenced on Fox News and other conservative news outlets as the AKP. He said, quote, Christianity is no longer a religion. It's a culture now. But that is not what a religion is like. A religion teaches. It is a form of life that gives one peace and happiness. That is what they want to turn Islam into as well. I'm not going to attempt the guy's name. Okay, maybe I will attempt it. But at any rate, Minister Erdogan Bakartrak. Nah, I shouldn't have attempted it. My little East Tennessee country tongue still isn't quite capable of moving like that. At any rate, this showed up in a report this past Wednesday in one of the daily newspapers in Turkey. It also said that there are 2.5 billion Christians in the world. The biggest three countries in the world are not Muslim countries. China, India, only the USA believes in a single God. Spirituality and religious feelings are weakening, this gentleman said, at an event hosted by a women's committee of the AKP. Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch, that's a blog, commented on the minister's assessment, saying, quote, in other words, he is telling his audience to be on guard against those who try to water down, or should we say moderate, the teachings of Islam. Those teachings include, presumably, the teachings of jihad warfare against unbelievers and their subjugation under the rule of Islamic law. Coming from an official of the ostensibly secular regime in Turkey, this is a noteworthy statement. He is essentially saying that Turkish secularism, which restricts key aspects of Islam, must be opposed. Now, Spencer, Robert Spencer, he is the guy who writes primarily for Jihad Watch. Now, this is a blog that essentially tries to keep track of radical Islam around the world, major stories popping up. So this makes his timeline for a reason. Now, it's also important to keep in mind, too, that this particular politician, Bayraktar, I'm still trying. I should stop trying. At any rate, this particular politician was forced to step down from his post as minister and as a member of the AKP party following a corruption investigation back in December. Now, if he's guilty of corruption, did these corruption charges have anything to do with the secular nature of their government? I don't know. I've tried looking a little bit deeper into that particular story and have not come up with anything as of yet. We will be keeping an eye on this. We've already seen that Turkey seems to be moving towards a more Islamo-fascist viewpoint. And we've seen that momentum moving. I don't know, maybe not everyone has, but I myself have seen this movement picking up speed in Turkey ever since the days of the first Iraq War under the elder Bush. I've seen this movement because I had people in my social media network from Turkey at one point in time. Most of them, since I've started this show, have dropped off. They seem more than willing to discuss world politics, but lots of times after that invasion, they started making all these various points about how racist, for example, that was just one time I heard that, how racist it was for America and how narcissistic the American president must be for getting involved in Iraq in such a fashion. And I'm sorry, but have we all forgotten the reason we went to war in Iraq in the first place? Kuwait was being invaded. Kuwait had been overrun by Saddam. And the entire Middle East was on board because they didn't want to be next. At that time and shortly after, the Kuwaiti people were extremely friendly towards Americans. Since then, they have become radicalized, for lack of a better term. And there are more people in Kuwait today that would rather kill an American than to shake one's hands. Now, that's not to say that everyone in Kuwait's that way. And I don't say that every Muslim wants to slit your throat in the streets. What I do say is we have no way of knowing who does and who doesn't. What I do say is that we are in very real danger. We have seen every possible sign that you can see in the past few weeks that our borders not only are even more porous than we had once believed, but that we have no way of knowing who is coming across the borders. There have been reports of people being spotted in and around Texas towns wearing ISIS logos. Now, I don't know if that's really somebody from ISIS that's come across the border or just some ridiculous punk that's an American-born who thinks that ISIS is cool. I mean, we have seen American youth embrace other violent movements and think that they're cool, haven't we? So at any rate, the number to call if you would like to make a comment about this before I change gears is, of course, 347-426-3550. I see Lady Michelle has just hopped into the chat room. Glad to see her checking in with us. Ordinarily, she's on early. And hello, Lady Michelle. Glad to see you here with us. Sorry you missed the interview in the first hour. I think you would have enjoyed it. Now, if anybody wants to call in and make a comment, you're more than welcome to. Would like to hear some of your thoughts in regards to it. It boggles my mind that he's going to lay out this plan. It boggles my mind. It took so long. It took so long to come out and say, oh, by the way, yes, we do have a plan. I just couldn't tell you about it kind of thing. And that's about what it is. I just don't know. This is supposed to be the leader of the free world. This is what we've got. This is what the consequence of the first election and the manipulation of the second election has brought to us. This is where we're at. This is really where we're at in America. How did this happen? Well, we've discussed how it's happening. It's just unbelievable. And I really don't know what else to say on the topic. Okay, so the Democrats think that we should just ignore Congress and that Obama should do this. And, you know, again, if he's going to take quick action to protect innocent people, so be it. I'm not opposed to that, per se. I am opposed to just garnering more authority than you actually have to the office. But at this point, nothing's going to stop him from doing that, short of impeachment. And Boehner and company have made it quite clear they're not interested in impeaching him because somehow they've got it in their head that this will bring about sympathy for the Democrats in the midterm election. How that works out, I don't know. Because if you present your case properly and you present the evidence, then the American people, instead of having sympathy for the Democratic Party, will see how lawless this administration has actually been. Why are you so afraid to do your job? Again, I keep coming back to this simple phrase. You begged for this job. Now do it. Do your job. That's what we sent you there for. Another story, and this story actually was part of the outrage of the week. The outrage of the week was going to be, for all intents and purposes, because we knew this was coming, Barack Obama once again taking on the mantle of Emperor Obama and signing a new executive order giving legal status to all these recent influx of illegal aliens. But now, even more outrageous is his decision not to. Not because his decision not to do it isn't the right thing, but because of why he chose not to do it. Because he came out and he said, we've decided not to do this until after the midterm elections. How outrageous is that? Are you really going to stand up there on your pedestal, which you and Michelle occupy, and talk down to those petty peasants, that, you know, the American people, and tell us that this is what's good for America. This is what we're going to do. But wait, some of you may not vote for Democrats in the midterm election. So, we're going to wait. It's still the humane thing to do. It's still the right thing to do. But it might cost us votes. So, we'll wait till later. That's what he just did. How outrageous is that? If you're going to stand on Obamacare being a great thing, then stand on Obamacare being a great thing and see what the American people tell you in the ballot box. If you're going to stand on immigration rights, which is also the dual section of our outrage of the week, the Labor Day speech Barack Hussein Obama gave, or he threw in immigration rights. Nobody has a right to immigrate here. We have a process that allows people to do so. But if you're going to stand on that as being a principle, if you're going to stand on that as saying, this is what's best for America, not just for these individual people, because we're going to do it because we care and because we love them. And these people, they just need a little nurturing and fully automatic weapons to shoot folks while they work for the drug cartels and, you know, just little things like that. Hey, Eric, go ahead. Send them some more guns. What? The American people know about Fast and Furious? Never mind. This is the caring thing to do. This, and then to admit, because that's what happened. He didn't actually say, we're going to do this because we're afraid we'll lose votes. He did it because he was getting pressure from the party to wait. Well, why do you think they wanted you to wait? They don't want to lose their elections, and they know several of the, what's the proper term that they use now, vulnerable? Several of the vulnerable Democrats that are running for the election might have a harder time, and assuming they're already expecting to have a hard time getting reelected, hence the phrase vulnerable in the first place, they might have a harder time getting reelected if you go ahead and do that now, because we have to support you in the party, but the constituents, a lot of them, they just don't understand. They're not as loving and caring as we are. They're not as smart as we are. We are the Democrats. We know better than you. So, the executive order is still coming. It's still on the way if Congress doesn't act to reform immigration. Comprehensive immigration reform. That's D.C. code for amnesty. That's not what we need. Now, do we need some immigration reform? Yeah, we could use some. We could use a ton of it, starting with, but not limited to, enforcement of current immigration laws, including possibly even focusing on enforcement of employers who violate hiring practices under immigration law. People who aren't using the verify system, people that are intentionally looking the other way, people who know that they're hiring illegals. There needs to be teeth in these laws, and they need to be enforced. But this has kind of become what I call the Howard Stern effect. You know how Howard Stern had his show on just regular airwaves on New York, despite the fact that it was in violation of FCC regulations. But because the FCC just looked the other way while Howard got more and more profane and more, well, we'll say less than decent in an attempt to be diplomatic, the raunchier he got and the more profane he got, the FCC just kept looking the other way. And then suddenly, out of the blue, the FCC says, you know what, Howard, we're not going to let you do that anymore. It's time that you played by the same rules everybody else did. And suddenly there was this big, I'm being targeted. This is not right. I'm taking my show over to Sirius. That's where he should have been to start with. If he wants to do that crap, he needs to do it in a pay service where presumably only adults will be listening. And there needs to be safeguards to make sure that only adults are listening. Because the FCC decency laws aren't there to protect adults from salty language. Lord knows most of us hear our fair share on a daily basis, whether we want to or not. Lord knows some of us are actually the ones out there being as salty as a sailor. I try not to be myself. Can't always say that I reach perfection on that count, but I make an effort. But neither here nor there. The FCC rules and regulations are designed to protect impressionable children from hearing this kind of filth. And, you know, whether you like Howard or not, it's hard to defend the content of a show as being anything other than filth. A lot of it was. Was it entertaining? Well, to a certain crowd of folks, I guess it was. He was one of the highest-rated shows out there and had a large debut when he went to the pay stations over there in the wonderful land of Sirius and XM and whatever's still operating over there now. I was never a fan of his, by the way, but you see, it's the same mentality. We've gotten away with it for so long. Why do we have to follow the rules now? Guess what? You should have been following the rules all along. Should have been following the rules all along. Less follow immigration law. Less enforce immigration law as it exists now. And while we're looking at immigration reform, let's find a way to make it a little bit easier for people to actually legally immigrate here. Not somebody to not make it as easy as, oh, well, the borders are open. But let's make it easier for the folks that are legitimately trying to get here. Let's do the background checks. Let's find out what they're about. Let's find out who they are. And let's go from there. That's the kind of reform I could get behind. Now, I had a caller last week who made the statement that he's to the point where he no longer wants any more immigration of any kind. He thinks we're at a saturation point for our territorial limits, for our resources. Limits. He may have a point. Do we really want any more immigration, legal or illegal? That's a different debate. But in the meanwhile, there should be no question that Congress should be taking a look at how do we make this easier for people who want to immigrate here the right way to be able to do so, and what do we do about all the criminals who are here? Because anybody who crossed that border, whether they came across the fence, whether they came across the Rio Grande, whether they stormed the beach in San Diego like a couple of weeks ago, they're here illegally, then they are criminals right off the bat. And a lot of these people are doing this because they were criminals before. Just makes me sigh. Let's change gears real quick. There's another story. This is from the headlines you may have missed. A lot of you may not have in this particular case, but because it's kind of picked up some steam since then. But there's a story about a teenager who was trying to get their driver's license in South Carolina. Here's the thing, though. This teenager, his name is Chase Culpepper. He's 16. He was born into a male body. See where I'm going with this? Well, it seems Chase considers himself to be, quote, gender nonconforming, and lives most of his time wearing women's clothing and makeup, although he still reportedly prefers male pronouns. He wants to be called he and him and so on. So he considers himself a guy, just nonconforming. Now, seems back in March, Chase went to the Department of Motor Vehicles in Anderson, South Carolina, to get his driver's license. But as the New York Daily News reports, the DMV staff made Chase remove his makeup to get his license photo taken because with the makeup on, he didn't look like a boy should. Quote, they said he was wearing a disguise. This according to Chase's mother, Teresa Culpepper. It was very hurtful. He was absolutely devastated. That's who he is, 24/7. Now, for Chase, his mother and the Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, the case is a clear violation of Chase's rights. And according to the reports, Chase's mother filed a lawsuit Tuesday against the South Carolina DMV. Quote, it was wrong to be taken aside and told how I look doesn't fit with traditional gender roles, and how I look is not even good enough to take a driver's license picture. Now, this is Chase talking, by the way. And, unfortunately, a lot of people like me have to go through this. The government should not be in the business of telling men and women how we are supposed to look as men and women. This according to Michael Silverman, the executive director of the TLDEF. But South Carolina DMV spokesman Beth Parks said Anderson staff were just following policy. She, in fact, said in a television interview back in August that the DMV policy was updated to say, quote, at no time will an applicant be photographed when it appears that he or she is purposely altering his or her appearance so that the photo would misrepresent his or her identity. Now, the lawsuit alleges that the DMV violated Culpepper's constitutional right to free speech and expression, and that the DMV's photo policy is unconstitutionally vague and broad. What I want to know is what you guys think on this one, because to me, it's pretty clear cut. First of all, when it comes to getting a driver's license, you don't have a right to expression. This isn't a freedom of speech issue. Now, we've made the point before about how the comparisons to states requiring you to have insurance to get a driver's license and the federal government requiring you to buy health insurance doesn't equate. And we keep coming back to the issue of here's the deal. States can legally put all kinds of restrictions on you, limiting what's required of you in order to get a license to operate a motor vehicle. Driving a car is not a constitutional right. Driving a car is not a right in any state. Driving a car is, in fact, considered a privilege in all 50 states. Therefore, the individual states can put these sometimes ridiculous, but as long as they don't cross a constitutional threshold, they can put these restrictions in place. But I'll go one further. Since the driver's license here in the United States of America has become the predominant form of personal identification, the legal identification that you will have, I think each and every state has both a legal and a moral slash a ethical requirement, an ethical mandate on them to make sure that these licenses represent the truest version of you. Since, in this case, the fact that he still prefers the male pronouns, Chase is still a guy, he just likes to look like a girl, then it's fair to say that even in his mind, he sees himself as a guy. So the state has a responsibility to make sure that his identity, as it is put forth via the driver's license, indicates that he's a guy, whether he's dressed up like a girl or not. But the fact that they want to throw freedom of speech in here shows right off the bat that they're trying to play an angle. So here's the deal. We're going to keep an eye on this case as it proceeds further. If the Culpeppers win this lawsuit, it will be one based on political correct nonsense as opposed to law. Because the law is very clear in this particular case. The DMV has a responsibility to make sure that these identifications are as accurate as possible. The DMV has a responsibility to try and make sure that you're not using them as a means to gather false identities. And whether or not this can be considered a disguise in the transgender community or whatever community he's claiming to be from, since technically he doesn't claim to be part of the gay or the transgender community, he just claims to be non-gender compliant. Now, that's a new classification as far as I'm concerned. I've never heard that classification used. So evidently he doesn't see himself as being gay. Evidently he doesn't see himself as a boy trapped in a girl's body waiting until he gets old enough to have a sex change. He sees himself as just not wanting to comply with what the standards are for our culture. So he's a rebel. He's a rebel, and that's it. Fine, if that's how you choose to rebel, you want to wear women's clothes and wear makeup, there are certainly things you could do that are far worse. So, Chase, kudos for your choice of expression. But guess what? Your DMV photo is not a place for self-expression. It's a place for you to be the truest form of you. And at least for now, in a biological sense, you are male. Now, if you change your mind later on and you have the surgeries, whatever, that's fine. But right now, according to your own words, you're a male. You're a guy. You're a dude. In your head, you're a dude. You just like dressing up like a woman because of whatever. So even in your own mind, you're not trapped in this question. You're not confused about your identity. You're not fighting for the rights of other people to do anything other than to try and make life more difficult for the DMV folks. And speaking for all the people that are in line behind you at the DMV, this crap is taking too long already. Stop making it harder. I honestly don't understand why this reaches the level of a lawsuit. What judge is going to hear this case? It scares me because if a judge is going to listen to this, they're probably waiting to be an activist on the issue. The law should be clear-cut. Now, going into the final 5 minutes of the show at this point, welcome to the newest guest in the guest room. Thanks for joining us. No real time for any calls at this point, but I wanted to make sure that we got those out. Other topics real quick that we should be keeping a look at and may have to spend a little more time looking at in the next little bit. The Ebola situation in Sierra Leone has forced authorities to order people to stay inside their homes. This is something that has been a bit unprecedented. Usually the Ebola outbreaks are very contained and they happen very quickly because normally you have close to a 90% fatality rate, and the people typically die fairly quickly, so they don't get to spread for very long. This Ebola outbreak has went on a lot longer than most, and it's got a lot of folks scared. But that seems to be the theme of the day. A lot of people are very frightened right now between the Ebola, which I've heard folks say it's being weaponized. ISIS has even threatened to weaponize it and use it against us. ISIS is a major concern here in the States. People are more afraid now than ever because we've seen how easily people are crossing the border. And we know that our federal government is doing nothing to actually help protect us. They're not doing their jobs. So I want to close today making sure that every one of you is doing everything you can to be safe, which means pay attention. Look what's going around. If you see something out of the ordinary, take steps to protect yourself and your family, because with the anniversary of 9/11 coming up, I think it's reasonable that we should expect something. And I also am sorry to say that I think it's also reasonable to expect that it could be happening here in the States this time. I think that opportunity is very real. I don't like being an alarmist, and I don't normally try to trumpet the conspiracy theories or what have you. I mean, I've told you before, there are some conspiracy theories that I think are dead on. I own a couple of tinfoil hats, and I'm not afraid to wear them when they're the topics of the day. But I don't like sounding like an alarmist, and I don't like criticizing people that are supposed to be protecting us. So let's give a heads up to the local police if we see something way out of character. And let's go back to being vigilant Americans who take care of each other. Let's join together with our family, our friends, our neighborhoods. Let's communicate. And let's help each other out. Because that's the real strength of America anyway. It's never been our government. It's never been our military. It has always been the people. In our base, we are good, we are generous, and we are awesome. Lady Michelle in the chat room is wishing everybody a great week and saying God bless, and I want to make sure that you're receiving that message right back. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for coming in late, Batfink and Karate. I haven't noticed you guys in the chat room here before. Hopefully you guys will be back. And guess what, ladies and gentlemen? As always, don't take my word for it, but definitely, definitely take their word for it. Take a little time. Do your own research. Do your own homework, because you've got to be prepared to put in some of your own effort if you really want to tap into the truth. God bless everybody. Keep in mind all those who paid the ultimate price when it came to September 11th. Love you guys, and we'll be back next week.
I've been watching, begging from the front door, like lightning, striking near twice before. We were so young, so we didn't really know how it feels to really have to let go. We went through just wanna fight. Don't you forget everything that we had. All been good and worse, better till it went bad. You know me better than anything, so I bet you saw this. Called you mine. We were like, wait, everything is gonna change. Hope when I come back you know my name. I don't think I can say all I need to say. With the time left counting down by the day, it wouldn't go by. I don't know why time flies. It's a heartbreak, but it